They have different hardware, different software. They've done it as well as they can. On the other hand, you know, space flight's risky business. It's cold out there. There's no air. There's stuff, meteors. Snowballs, giant snowballs. You hear the giant snowball theory? There's giant snowballs out there. Of course, if you're thirsty, no problem. Software, yeah, okay. So redundant software and software used in a lot of space applications has multi-version. And many safety systems have redundant software. And in fact, there's even Tandem, I guess, has software implemented redundancy in some of its processing. It typically multiplies the cost of implementation by the desired level of redundancy. So if you want a triple redundancy, that means three times the development cost plus. Three times the hardware, and oh, by the way, it runs as fast as the slowest one. Hard to guess passwords are another useful thing. You know, some people say passwords are dead, and we need to use the things like secure ID that generate pseudo-random passwords as a function of time. And I certainly believe that that's valuable, but a lot of systems still use passwords, and ultimately, that's not going away as far as I can tell. The various ways to make that better is automatically generated passwords, systems that check passwords when they're entered, systems that try to guess passwords to detect forced selections after the fact. And for example, there's a system that generates pronounceable passwords, pseudo-random pronounceable passwords, I call them mantras. You might get Numajaki or Papa Remy or, you know, Kiyomua, like that, so that you can remember them. You can type them in reliably, but they're generated out of pseudo-random lists, and you can tell just how hard to guess they are. Now, you don't need to write them down, because you can remember these without having to write them down. Okay? You get a list of 20 or 30 of them, you pick one that you like, and you can remember it fairly easily. And it's very hard to guess, or you can predict how hard to guess it is. So it's actually very effective, and you don't have to write it down. The problem with a truly random password, like, you know, GMZ3 capital R lowercase N4XY, is nobody can remember it. But Kamutano, you can remember if you try. There are programs that generate those lists. There's the issue of how good your pseudo-random number generator is. We discussed that earlier in the day. But there are actually several widely available programs. I think I actually published one of them. But basically, pseudo-random number generator, you take, in this case, pairs of pronounceable, you know, vowel consonant combinations, and you just list them. If the list is 100 of those, and you take a sequence of 5, and it's picked at random from each of the 5, then it's 1 in 100 to the 5th, or 10 to the 10th. Yeah. It's real straightforward to analyze and understand, easy to remember, easy to pronounce, hard to guess. Augmented authentication devices, such as the one I just showed you, this is a simulation of it. Sometimes, before we were talking about something you know, this is something you have. Authentication typically is something you know, something you have, or something you are. Okay, this is the something you have version. The secure ID authentication device and other similar cards, algorithmic authentication, and challenge response cards, where you punch in whatever the challenge number was sent by the computer and it tells you the response. And you can do this both directions to authenticate the computer to you as well as you to the computer, which I consider to be a real good idea. There are various issues with this, but it's well within the realm of doable today, commonly off-the-shelf available. Then we have biometrics, that is something that you are, the third leg of the authentication stool. Examples include fingerprints, voice prints, retinal blood vessel patterns, DNA sequences, and facial characteristics. And at the last conference, they had one of the vendors demoing a facial characteristic. They look at the pattern of blood vessels in your face, and they discriminate pretty well and like that. There are problems. The overall biometric authentication is a pretty complicated field. They're normally used to authenticate identities that is, you know who it is and you're trying to demonstrate within reason that it is them, or to differentiate between members of a fairly small population. Okay, so you have 1,000 people, which one is this? They can do that. 10,000 people, not so well. This is Joe Beluca, I can say pretty close to clearly this is indeed Joe Beluca. Better than the guard at the gate can do by looking at the picture. Okay, but 1 in 1,000 people will pass even though they're not Joe. There's limits on authorization. For example, you can limit in time, space, location, function, and other characterizable parameters. Put limits on when a user can make certain classes of requests, a time lock, so to speak. Where requests can be made from, IP address restrictions, location-based access, which terminal you're on. You can't log in as root except from the console, these kinds of things. And then how much information an individual may attain, for example, time limitation on quantities. How many requests you can make per hour for this kind of information can be limited. And this is used in several systems I can't tell you about. So I can't think of any off the top of my head where this is used in a commercial application. It's not a complicated thing to do. You can have arbitrarily complex restrictions, and that creates various difficulties, especially in consistency and completeness. But generally speaking, this is something that's straightforward. Marking and labeling. Markings are of some sort of use to identify the sensitivity level of information. For example, electronic marking within computer systems, physical marking on a sheet of paper, and labeling of tapes and other storage media. It's easy to do. Requires systematic procedures that are rigorously followed. Just have a stamp on it that says classified or secret or confidential or company confidential or privacy or whatever. Well, if that's going to work, you need to classify information as to sensitivity. And in fact, there's probably a legal requirement to classify information as to sensitivity if you want to have, for example, trade secret protection. Because if you haven't identified it and differentiated it properly, then you don't have legal protection. So, for example, the standard classification process in most large businesses and government agencies is a good example. Automated classification and trusted system based on information derived from. And declassification process used by the government periodically to reassess the sensitivity of information. And the process of determining proper classification is really complicated and currently requires people that are experts do it. Dynamic password change control. This is where we force people to periodically change their passwords, which means that they have to write them down and forget them, and it's too complicated and nobody likes it. We all hate it, but we do it sometimes. The trade-off is unclear here. Periodic. The other one is use-based change requirements. After you've used the password 15 times, you have to move on. Or protection against reuse of passwords and various trivial variations on past passwords. So that if you're changing your password and it used to be Joe and it's now Joe2, it'll say you can't do that. Please note that by indicating you can't do that, it may also be revealing information. Means it's stored information on your past passwords. That's not necessarily a good idea. But it makes things a bit harder on the users. So there's value in it, I guess. Yeah, no, usually it's not on the screen. It's on the area around the edge of the screen because you can't see the screen when it's on that person that's on the screen. Yes, we've all seen the movies. Secure design. We could actually, I'm sorry, this is a family slide. No. We could design hardware, software, and networks more securely, and that makes attacks more difficult. There is proven secure software, there are verified designs, and there are inherently secure architectures, or inherently more secure architectures. For example, an Ethernet is inherently more difficult to secure than a star type configuration for a variety of reasons. Of course, it's sort of harder to make things secure and functional than to make them merely functional. And most people just want them to be functional. Nobody knows exactly how much harder, but there seems to be some notion that making something secure might imply verifying security properties, and that's commonly known to be very complex. But we don't verify those properties anyway. Instead, we test them, but we don't test them very well. In testing, we use testing to improve the assurance that protection is effective. For example, regression testing, that's where we test against all the previous known problems, okay? So when you release the new version of your C library, You should test it against all the attacks that worked on all the previous versions of the C library to make sure they haven't been reinserted. Of course, the major computer manufacturers seem to be unable to accomplish this. So as a user, you may have to be the person that does regression testing on new versions of software. Then there's functional testing, and everybody does this. Functional testing, that's where the thing says your password has to be at least 6 characters. So you try a 5-character password, it says no, and you say, okay, it passed. That doesn't mean that there isn't some other 5-letter password that'll work. That's called functional testing. Okay? Then there's what's called protection testing. And protection testing, you actually go in and try and figure out whether it's going to do the right thing all the time. And nobody knows how to do that very well, but like I told you, on the average, if I do protection testing, every 4 hours I find a hole that lets me take over your system. So there must not be too much of it going on, or it'd be more than 4 hours. And then there's the whole notion of complete tests, which are infeasible in all but the most simple systems. And there are lots and lots of techniques and lots of citations in your bibliography to techniques. And it abounds with complexity issues. It's almost never feasible for large classes of tests that we would like to perform. Nevertheless, we can do a lot better than we are doing. And there's known attack scanning. For example, virus scanning looks for known viruses. Pattern matching against audit trails for known attack signatures and virus monitors that check each program every time it's ready to load for known viruses. And it's almost always used to identify a finite subset of an infinite class of attacks. And so it's only effective against the commonly known examples, but then that may be effective. That is, in a broad scale, that might be beneficial to us all to eliminate the known ones. Although there is some case to be made that by eliminating the common variants on malicious things, we make it easier for the survival of the less common variants, this leaving the biological analogy rather interestingly. So-called superbugs. Accountability. You hold people accountable for their actions. So you identify each information asset, who owns it, who has stewardship over it, and they're held accountable for the assets and for their actions. And the examples include the various processes of vesting ownership and information, owner-based access control decisions, where the owner or steward actually gets to make the control decisions rather than some systems administrator, where you might be tracking activities to individuals as part of the way you audit and track things. And performance measures of individuals are all examples of accountability. It can be quite complex, and it's muddled by legal and organizational limitations, but it's out there. Good technique. Integrity shells are essentially you use cryptographic checksums to check information just before it's used, and there are several products in the market that do this. And the object is to drive the complexity of corruption up by forcing the attacker to maintain cryptographic checksum while making a modification. And so this is fairly effective, but people don't like it for whatever reason, ergonomically maybe. We have fine-grained access control. Instead of this gross sort of you can access the file or not, we need for example, you have a big database. You have 50,000 or 500,000 or 5 million or 50 million or 500 million records in this database. To say Joe can read the database is a little bit broad. Okay? So instead, you might want to say, Joe can read all the fields that Mary wrote. Or Joe can read all the fields about employees in occupation 37. So it's a finer grained access control. So you might go field-based, record-by-record controls, or even multi-level marking of documents. Now, it turns out, in general, determining the accessibility of data that's being analyzed by Turing-capable programs is NP-complete, and in some cases it may even be it's not only undecidable, in some cases it might be impossible, which is sort of interesting. But we have change management, where we control changes so as to increase the assurance that they are valid. For example, change control systems for software we've talked about. Now, this is different than sound change control, okay? We're not talking about verifying every line of code, we're talking about managing the process of changing things. Okay? For example, we would like to be able to roll back and back out of a change. Okay? I don't know, how many of you here use firewalls? Anybody have a firewall? We've seen these before, okay? In a firewall, I did evaluations of firewalls at one point, and one of the things I found out is that nobody on the market, only one of the products on the market had a firewall that could back out of a change. where you could say, uh-oh, everything's broken. Take me to the last configuration. You push a button and it takes you back. I'd consider that like before how well it works. I'd consider backing out of a change like that to be critical. Okay? So there's an example of change management where that particular technology hasn't kept up, but there are lots of things where backout is feasible and is done and widely used. And of course, strong change control processes in select critical application. Okay? And verifying the propriety of change is very difficult. In essence, it's impossible. But there are common techniques for testing changes that should be used. Configuration management is where you're managing configurations as opposed to change. So that, for example, if you're in the telephone business and you have 5,000 telephone switches strewn throughout the United States and you want to change the configuration so that these new kinds of phone calls can get through, you have to do that systematically. You need a mechanism to roll that change in so it doesn't just happen to all of them and they all fail at once. So you can roll them in slowly and test ahead of time and this sort of thing. This is configuration management. There are a lot of things that have menu-based tools, tools to manage firewalls, et cetera. In fact, tomorrow we have one group, and then on Tuesday we have 8 or 9 companies that do network security management that are coming to participate in a national InfoSec technical baseline on this subject matter. That is, what is the state of the art in this field? So if you are attending the conference and have nothing to do for those hours, you're welcome to sit into the sessions and listen to me ask embarrassing questions of vendors. Now, I'm not guaranteeing that you'll be able to listen to any answers, because they're allowed to say, I'll get back to you on that one, Fred. I did this for companies for a while, and all the vendors got to know me, and the companies would say, all right, well, we're going to have somebody here to assist us, and they said, this is going to be Fred calling. Yes, okay, we'll send our top technical people. So they all, the salesmen are, asking the embarrassing questions, they don't know how to answer it. Another technique is lockouts. Entry points or functions are locked to prevent their use. Typically, this is in response to some identified threat. For example, man traps. I don't think we've reached person traps yet. They're still called man traps. Used to prevent a detected intruder from escaping. Lockouts of computer accounts based on incorrect authentication. Lockouts used to prevent people from using systems or network components while they're under maintenance. So while we're doing repair, we disable this thing from the network. Now, there's an interesting case I had recently of one of my clients where I did a test that demonstrated that their whole network was vulnerable to something, and they came back and said it can't be, and we tested it again and found that it wasn't vulnerable, and we traced it back, and they found out that what happened was they had a lockout for their firewall so that when they were doing an update to their firewall, they locked it out of operation, but the default mode was unlimited access instead of no access. So you have to be careful about how you lock things out. If you use them automatically, you're at risk of denial of service attacks from your enemy. We have the whole area of drop boxes and processors. We have a secure facility provided for putting valuable information or documents so it can't be removed except by an authorized individual. Real good example is the IBM Abyss processor for secure network-based processing. Anybody here remember the Abyss processor? Anybody ever heard of it? The classic, called Dave Chess, or those guys over at IBM. They built one. It's physically secured, about the size of a modem box. It was a nifty box. You could put stuff in, you could never get anything out. It could talk to other Abyss processors and actually do things, but it was neat. Password analysis. Components that take in passwords and reveal only whether they were right or wrong, rather than storing the password file on the disk somewhere. You have a box, and you feed in the password, and it says yes or no. So there is no password to steal. It's a locked process. And Dropbox is used to put disks in for secure disposal. You drop in the disk, and you can only open it after you put it through the shredder or what have you. There's no big complexity issue here. Just have to decide what's worth doing it and do it. Authentication of packets. You essentially add into the data field of a packet the data and a cryptographic checksum that allows you to authenticate that this packet is legitimate based on their ability to create the proper crypto checksum. There's also another way to do it is by authenticating the routing information or have some redundancy that's inherent in the data. For example, the state and the zip code are redundant in some sense. If the zip code doesn't match the state, the data is not valid. Just a thought. So there are some complexity issues, and of course you have all the cryptography involved here. So analysis of physical characteristics, like physical characteristics of system components or infrastructures analyzed to detect deviations. Time domain reflectometers is an example where you detect wiring changes in listening devices by looking at electronic signals that you send down the line and look at reflections in the wire, and you can detect a lot of bugging devices this way. Use pressure and gas sensors in pipes containing critical wiring to detect people breaking into the pipes. Or you can look at dollar bills or identity cards to detect forgeries. Okay, so there are various tamper resistance. So you can use one of those color pens to draw on a dollar bill, and it'll change colors if it's not, or change colors if it is a legitimate dollar bill, and not if it's not, into the right color. And there are a variety of these techniques used for a variety of different identity technologies. No fundamental complexity limitations are inherent in these things. They might be difficult to use in networked environments or where the physical processes cannot be easily controlled. Something that a lot of people use is encrypted authentication. That is, they don't want to encrypt the whole session for performance reasons or what have you, but they'll encrypt the password as it's sent over the wire. So encryption of plain text passwords or other, if you're going to use biometrics over a network, you need to encrypt the biometric information with a time variant encryption. Otherwise, your fingerprint looks exactly the same now as it did before. Okay, or close, an exact. If it worked last time, it'll work this time if your fingerprint system's any good. Or something like that. But if so, you have to encrypt that authentication. And then another similar technique is where you distribute the authentication information over multiple paths to reduce the path dependency. It's basically an encryption issue. So there will be lots of difficulties involved. Okay, we only have like 9 minutes left before the afternoon break. Then we go into the stretch. Tempest protection, protecting against the exploitation of electromagnetic emanations. This comes from the tempest in a teapot. I guess somebody put a bugging device in somebody's teapot in the White House or something. I don't know. Which administration was that? Harding? Sounds right. Sounds like that. Something you would find in the Harding administration. Hey, you know, it's not only live presidents, right? In America, we can talk about dead presidents in strange ways also. So examples are Faraday cages to reduce emanations in the appropriate frequency ranges, the use of special low emanations components, power levels, and designs, and then the filtering of power supplies in these things to limit the emanations coming out of things. You can use increased or enhanced perimeters. So we just, for example, we can widen the perimeter area just by making bigger distances. You know, a lot of corporate headquarters have large fields or woods around them with distant fences. Make the perimeter bigger. It makes it harder for somebody to stand there with their VanEck device in the van sitting out front. Of course, they'll just drive in the parking lot. But improve strength or quality in the perimeters. Better fences, higher fences, razor wire, you know, minefields, etc. Rottweilers, yeah. And defense in depth, use of multiple perimeters in combination, such as a moat and a wall. Right, a moat's easy to swim over, a wall's easy to knock down or climb over, but try and knock down a wall while you're standing in a moat. Try and get out the other side of the moat when there's a wall in front of you. Of course, perimeters are expensive, and more bigger, broader, more redundant perimeters are more expensive. Noise injection. You inject noise in order to reduce signal-to-noise ratios to make compromise more difficult. For example, create deceptions involving false or misleading information. That's essentially introducing noise. Introducing electrical, sonic, other forms of noise to reduce the usability of emanations. And create active noise-reducing barriers to eliminate external sources, which might cause, for example, speech input devices to take external commands. Okay, anybody hear about the thing? You know, Apple has like voice input, and now some of the IBM compatible PCs have speech input. And somebody had once expressed the fear that somebody would run down the hall screaming, "Format C, enter, yes, enter," or something like that. Just, you know, just run down the hall screaming this, and everybody's disk formats itself, right? So, hey, as we use voice input devices, remember, the voice input devices don't only listen in the frequencies you can hear. A lot of them work in ultrasonic ranges. So now I can induce an ultrasonic signal that you can't hear. The computer hears and interprets as voice input and sends the answer back in ultrasound. Talk about a covert channel. Okay, now if I'm giving away any of the offensive techniques here, then I have to talk about equity issues at some point. Jamming. Signals are used to disrupt communication. Examples include the use of noisy signals to make bugging devices inoperable. Noise signals, not noisy signals. You introduce noise, electromagnetic noise, so that the transmission that the bugging device sends can't get out. It can't get above the signal-to-noise ratio. Introduce noise into files transmitted over the infrastructure to make it unusable without the proper noise removal methods, or the disruption of audio signals. Oh, say again? Different from encryption. Well, for example, I can induce noise into a TV picture. You can still see the picture. It's not made the picture invisible, but the quality is crap. So it's just the interdiction of noise. It's not generally encryption is transforming information into a form that's unusable. It's not unusable, it's just not as usable. Okay? For example, what they do in a lot of the so-called scrambling for video in the satellite signals is they mess up the synchronization signal. So it doesn't synchronize properly, so the picture rolls and flaps around and all this stuff. And then with what they give you when you buy the service is the sync signal. So it's just it's not quite up to encryption, it's just meager. Does that answer that question? Good. Spread spectrum is an interesting. The use of frequency hopping radio devices to reduce the effect of jamming and complicate listening in on communications. For example, there are now spread spectrum portable telephones that are available for your home and spread spectrum radios that have been used in the military for a long time. And the basic issues in spread spectrum are how rapidly you change the frequencies, how do you schedule the frequency sequences to make jamming and listening difficult. And like this, the former is an electronics problem and the other one is essentially a cryptographic problem. There's the idea of using path diversity. You use multiple paths to reduce the dependency on a single route of communication or transportation. For example, you use different motor routes selected at random near the time of use to avoid hijacking of shipments. You use multiple network paths to assure reliability and increase the cost of jamming or bugging. Using multiple suppliers and multiple apparent delivery names and addresses to reduce the effect of Trojan horses placed in hardware. You get how rapidly do you change paths and how do you pick the path sequence. The rapidity of changing paths has to do with it's a logistics problem, and the other one is basically a cryptographic problem. Yes, one of the major problems with diversity, and not only path diversity in the telephone infrastructure where it's obviously pretty poor, but in all sorts of diversity is, you need a way to assure that it's real. And in effect, today there is no way to assure that over our telecommunications infrastructure. However, it's likely that this will be addressed sometime in the near future, and you will actually be able to order redundant paths that are guaranteed to have path diversity. By the way, you know, you can use the path diversity in the same way as encryption. Right? You send the bits over different lines. Same thing. tri-quad and multi-angulation. This is a, for example, use multiple signals from different views to coordinate in order to uniquely locate. For example, signal triangulation to locate ships on the Earth, which is a near plane. You can use quadrangulation in the GPS to locate a point in three space plus time. If you have five, you can get accurate time as well. And although it's pretty accurate anyway because of tens of time signals, so it's within a, probably within a microsecond no matter what, you know, but you can do better. Use some multiple audit trails in the network infrastructure to locate the source of a signal or a malicious bitstream. Essentially the same thing. Of course, while Euclidean spatial location is fairly straightforward, additional mapping capability is required for cyberspace infrastructure and these sorts of multi-angulation. And it's closely related to mathematical results in finding cuts to partition the network. Faraday boxes. You have conductive enclosures. Ooh, time. Beep. Time for break. So, for example, you do a periodic review of audit trails by systems administrators. This, at least for some long period of time, was required for all military systems. Now, an average Unix system, for example, puts out something like a megabyte a day of audit trails. So how many, anybody here ever try to review a megabyte of audit trails at the end of your day before going home to that meal and bed? Well, I'll tell you that anybody that's ever done this more than once is either a glutton for punishment or hasn't done it right, and because it's just about impossible to do it all. Another posteriori examination of audit trails and other systems information is often used to track attackers. And in fact, this is one of the most powerful things that we have in trying to track down attackers is the audit trail. And auditive protection bit settings and file content in operating environments, another example where you go into the detailed audit process. And ours tend to be quite complex to perform, especially these detail audits, require that the auditor have a tremendous amount of knowledge and skills suitable to making these determinations. I mean, in reality, how can you expect an auditor to do it when nobody else can do it? No, it's not just a matter of time. Well, for example, how do you tell whether a particular sequence is indicative of an attack or not? Right? There might be some sequence of events that happened over a period of 5 days that consist of three events over 5 days that in combination caused some denial of service or leaked some information or something like that. And you have to pick it out of a megabyte a day. So you're picking out, you know, 80 bytes or 100 bytes out of 5 megabytes. And they could appear anywhere. And there are a potentially infinite number of such sequences. Okay, so I just... Yes, it's not just a matter of recognizing one of 50 known patterns. It's a potentially infinite space. And in fact, the only way that we really know how to do it, as far as I can tell, and the way people do this, is they hold in their brain a model of what the computer system is doing. And every audit trail, they update the model. And as they go through that, at some point they say, wait a minute, I seem to recall that these two other things happened before and that in combination that means this. Well, my goodness. it hurts. And it's, I mean, people aren't that good at it. But I mean, just to give you a sense of this, they did experiments. This isn't auditing, but it's very closely related to this. There have been experiments on planting of surreptitious code in programs to see whether you can detect it. And essentially what they did, they started out with a lot of code, moved towards little code. And I can't tell you what the number is of how many lines of code, but you would be amazed at how closely you have to identify where the problem is before even the best experts can find it. It's very easy to plant malicious code inside other code. Well, examining, three, 5 megabytes of audit trails to look for the 150 or 200 bytes indicative of what you're trying to find is a similar problem. If I could narrow it down to like 2K, you still might not find it. Okay, so it's a very difficult thing. Now, in practice, what people do, I'm just going to page up here. In practice, what people do in detailed audit is they find things they know about, they find bizarre things, and if they're looking for something in particular, they have a fair chance of finding it if they're very good at it. Okay? They certainly don't find them all. If you did experiments, it might be worth doing, but if you did a lot of experiments, you would probably find that they don't find 1 in 1,000. Encouraging, isn't it? On the other hand, when I do a detailed audit of a system, it's not unusual for me to find hundreds of things that have to be fixed in that system. So, and if I only found 1 in 1,000, that's 100. Oh my God. Well, I guess more bits are set right than wrong. You only have to change about half of them. It's which half is the problem. Trunk access restriction is something that's commonly used, especially in telephone systems. High bandwidth or privileged access ports and lines are restricted. For example, protection of trunk telephone lines from access by calls originating on outside lines. Now, please note that in a dual-headed PBX, things that can cross from head-to-head may be able to get an outbound line, even though they were from outside on one PBX. When you cross from one head to the other, you're now on an inside line if it's not properly implemented. Limiting access to high bandwidth infrastructure elements and physically securing an Ethernet within a building. These are all restricting access to trunks. This is not hard to do. Might require substantial effort, but it doesn't take rocket science. You can control the flow of information. For example, you can use mandatory access controls in trusted systems. Router configuration is very commonly used to limit the flow of information between areas of an organization, and then also to keep information within an organization from leaking out. And they tend to be based on work models when they're effective. That is, you have a model of how the information flows on the job, and you're allowing the information to flow the way it flows and not flow in other ways. Flow control has been studied in some detail. There are some published results on complexity, a lot of work by Denning in the 70s, and it's related to the Bella, Pagel, and Bible model as well. You can disconnect maintenance access. For example, maintenance ports are disconnected. You don't always have to disconnect it. You can use cryptographic modems for covering maintenance ports. Another common technique is the connection of maintenance ports only when maintenance is taking place. So, when you have external maintenance people, your machine's broken, you know it. Go over, flip the modem, call them up, say, are you ready? Go, turn on the modem. Listen, all right, they're in, watch the session underway, stay on the phone with them, watch what they're doing. When they're done, you go, okay, goodbye, click, turn it off. That's extremely effective. Another one is the elimination of non-local use of maintenance functions. Now, this is fairly difficult, for example, in maintaining an internet or a set of routers throughout a corporation from a central location. But wherever possible, if you can do it locally, that's an advantage. It's important and effective to have an effective protection mindset. Organizations with effective awareness programs tend to have this. Organizations with a strong tradition and culture of protection tend to have this. And individuals have this when they have a passion for the field. Obviously, trying to control human behavior isn't that easy, but corporate culture seems to have a great deal to do with it. And you'll find that in cultures with poor protection mindsets, there are all sorts of problems. And in corporations with good protection mindsets, they have much fewer in the way of protection problems. You can put physical switches or shields on equipment and other devices. For example, you can physically write lock disks. You guys remember the good old days? I call it the good old days, right? When computers were slow and people were fast. At least I was. In the good old days, there was a button on every disk drive, and you push it, and it's write locked. Can't write. You push it the other way, and it's write enabled. Well, they actually, almost every disk still has a write lock and write enable pin on it somewhere. And that's a very effective way to limit access to disk. about physical covers over the front of video cameras. Okay, you just have a little black thing you stick over the front of it, and then the camera doesn't work. Switches that electronically or mechanically disconnect microphones. Okay, in some environments I know of, when we have PBX run digital telephones, you unplug the wire, and then you're allowed to have your conversation. And when you're done, you plug it back in. It works real well. Keyed disconnects for keyboards, mice, and displays. In fact, some of the vendors that come to these conferences will have something that looks like a key that's in your pocket. It's just a key. You stick it in, and you're now you have access. It has the encryption necessary to make the connection between your mouse and keyboard and display in your computer. You take out your key, you can't use the computer anymore. If it's on your keychain, you're not likely to go home without it. In fact, you're not likely to walk through the building without your key. The computer can stay on, just nobody can do anything with it. You just take your key out. You put it back in when you want to use it. That's a very nice technology. Trusted repair teams. Well, since you can't trust the repair process, you have to find some way to mitigate those risks. So you get cleared repair people. They're more expensive. Specially contracted repair facilities. Of course, that special contract has to be, you know, there's problems with that. And you can also put your repair teams into special facilities to do the repair. You own the facility. They come in and do the repair, and you check them when they exit. They can't leave with a disc or a tape. You know, so you have to have big tapes. These days, tapes are so little. You know, I can put about 10 gigabytes in my shirt pocket, well, 20 gigabytes easily in my shirt pocket. You can't even hardly notice. Not to mention that in my pocket computer, I can probably put a couple gigabytes. Not in this one. I'm not recording this entire session on my pocket computer. But the technology is not far. This is dominated by people issues. Inventory control, where you track inventory at a granularity level, is sufficient to identify the relevant history of relevant stuff. Physical inventory, inventory audits, and of course online inventory over information. Okay, you literally check in and out a file. On a network, you check out a file of this person, and you check it back in, and you check what's changed from when you checked it out to when you checked it in, and make sure that's allowable. And there are systems that do that. Secure distribution. You deliver things in such a way as to assure various security properties. Cryptographic checksums can be used to seal the software distribution even over public communication systems, assuming that you can somehow securely distribute the verification key. Trusted couriers are used for securing, in secure carrying cases, right? Physical cases that blow up if you try and slice my hand off, which is, that's how we do that, right? If you've got one of those briefcases, that means instead of stealing a briefcase, we need to slice your hand off. So we slice off your hand, remove your hand, then you know how handcuffs work. You just feed them right through, and then you wrap them around my wrist, and now it's secured to me. Of course, then I cut off your wrist.